Back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, here with my teammates. There's Danny King, writer for the Film Stage.
Hey, just in time for the ice cream truck to drive by behind me.
Do you hear that stuff? I do hear it.
Okay, yeah. But yeah, hey.
Our discussion topic today will be, if you could like waylay an ice cream truck, what would you get? I usually get the Snoopy Pop. I don't know about everyone else. That's been my favorite for a while. We also have Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Choco Taco is one of the best, I think.
I can get behind that. I'm a fan of the Choco Taco. Yeah. We also have a special guest, and that is Joe Galbo.
Yep. What up, Internet? How's it going, guys?
Already, the energy level on this podcast has reached levels that it has never found before. Joe, ice cream selection.
I go classic. Ice cream sandwich or bust.
Oh, all right. Not even like a chipwich. Uh-huh. You're a straight sandwich guy.
No, ice cream sandwich. No messing around.
Sweet. Danny, you still haven't answered this question.
I agree. Ice cream sandwich or just get out.
Whoa. All right.
Yeah.
So if I went up and ordered like a chocolate eclair, I would just get some.
If I was running that stand, I wouldn't serve you.
Sweet. Okay. Well, today we'll be talking about X-Men Days of Future Past. Joe, you're here under particular circumstances, so why don't you tell the fine people at home what the hell you're doing here?
I am. Well, I, like any red-blooded American, purchased my way into this podcast. Through Kickstarter, I supported Strange Bird, a film by, who is it again? Who's those clowns that you guys know? It's, Mecca, and who's the other guy?
Tim Ringwood.
Dan Mecca. Tim Ringwood, there he is. That's it. Thank you. So that's their film that they Kickstarted, and this was one of the perks. For $150, I got to be on the podcast and everything above, which was like, you know, t-shirts and mugs and grainy photos from the set. It's it's been delightful.
So did you actually want to give $150, or did you look at it and say, oh, I love that show, I would like to be on that?
Well, it was I'm familiar with the Film Stage. I've known Jordan Raup for a little while, so I've done a couple articles for the Film Stage, and I knew you guys did a podcast, but I'd never really listened to it until, you know, I purchased my way in, so I apologize for that, but I'm happy to be here now.
Okay, well,
that's good news.
You didn't listen to it and then immediately say, oh God, I've made a terrible mistake.
No. If I was smarter with my money, I probably should have listened to it first and then decided whether or not I wanted to get involved. But I like going, you know, full on things. So here I am. But yeah, long story though, Dan Mecca did some videography for my wedding. And in lieu of actually paying him, I agreed to support his Kickstarter campaign. And yeah, this was... I valued him at about $150, and here we are.
Man, there's all kinds of like backroom deals and like Byzantine plots going on in this. But you know, it's good to have you.
So someone getting married inadvertently led to a podcast appearance. If you think about it.
There you go.
That's probably the most elaborate way anybody's ever ended up on this show.
Probably. I'm hoping that we can break that in the future, though.
Wait, Nick was at a wedding during one show.
He was driving to the wedding. Okay.
And then I got there and I changed into a suit while I was recording it, if you'll recall.
It was by far our sexiest episode.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Nick, it wasn't your wedding, though, was it?
No, it was Jordan.
Oh, okay.
That would be even better.
Very cool. But no, I'm excited to be here, guys, and I really appreciate you letting me come into your little world and, you know, talk about movies and stuff like that. It's a lot of fun. I love movies, and I'm really happy to be here today.
Excellent. Now, I'm just going to say, I'm now, like, obsessed with the idea of, like, a sitcom where the main character is a podcaster, and somehow he has to record a podcast during his wedding. So he has, like, covertly placed a Bluetooth or, like, his speakerphone somewhere on his person, and he's trying to make his vows fit his opinion of the movie. And then the end, it's like, so do you think people should see this movie? And it'd be a beautiful little sync up where he says, I do. Anyway. So I'm going to get to work on the pilot for that show.
That's a Jason Segel vehicle if I've ever heard one.
Oh hell yeah.
I was going to say Jason Statham, but,
yeah. That is even better. All right, well, anyway, pleasantries aside, let me just remind everyone that we are on Twitter, and we're constantly giving away stuff. Well, yeah, I would say we've been pretty good at giving away stuff. Nothing this week, but I think next week or the week after we'll have more Blu-rays to give away. So follow us on Twitter, @FilmStageShow. As always, you can comment on the Film Stage under the posts that these are posted under. You can also find us on iTunes. Give us a comment. Give us a rating. We always love getting those. And if you have anything to say in the long form, email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. Before we get into our feature review of X-Men Days of Future Past, we wanted to briefly talk about some news that came through the interwebs this week. And that is that Edgar Wright, the director of such films as The World's End and Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, has left the Ant-Man movie. For anyone who doesn't get why this is a big deal, he was developing this film for quite some time, and everyone was really excited because he's
8 years.
Eight years. I mean, that's quite some time, isn't it?
It was actually announced in the same press release as the first Iron Man and the Incredible Hulk. He was on Ant-Man longer than Robert Downey Jr. has been Iron Man. If you want to think about that,
that is a pretty intense way to think about it.
Intense, yes.
But, you know, news came suddenly that he had departed the project, which will be starring Paul Rudd and Michael Douglas, oddly enough. And, yeah, there's been speculation as to why. I think the Latina Review said that it was because of script issues. Apparently the heads at Marvel had changed the script to the point that Edgar Wright no longer felt like it was his vision, and so he abandoned the project. And so this is kind of big news because, really, as much as I've enjoyed some of the Marvel films, you can't really say that they carry an artistic vision. They don't really have the imprint of the creators on them. I mean, Christopher Nolan, you can definitely tell his Batman films. I would say that maybe the closest Marvel has gotten is when Kenneth Branagh directed Thor. But I mean, even the movie Chef is a pretty thinly veiled analogy that John Favreau made in response to being jerked around by the studio system on his films.
As someone who I follow on Twitter said, that's probably the least interesting subtext in film history. But yes.
So I wanted to talk about this because we here at the Film Stage Show, as anyone who's heard us, you know, so Joe, maybe you don't know this, mm-hmm. As anyone who's listened to us can tell you, we're all about the artistry, and I would say most of us hew pretty closely to something related to the auteur theory, and we really can see the artistic imprint of the people working on a film. It's rare that we don't mention a director in some capacity. And so, to see a director who actually has an eccentric and original vision, because even though I don't like all of his films, I can't say that Edgar Wright makes a movie like anyone else. To see him depart a movie that he's been on, as Nick has informed us, for 8 years because the studio had just bastardized the script to that point, allegedly, is a little bit of a shock. So, Nick Newman, what do you think this says about the future of our blockbuster entertainment, or just the way that artists in this franchise-driven world are being handled, especially with all this interconnected continuity?
Well, I don't think it says anything about the future of this franchise business because it's sort of what's going on already.
So you're saying it's like a whatever good future there could have been has just been recorrected to the present?
Sort of. I mean, that doesn't mean that there is no hope for the future of these sorts of things, but really it's just indicative of what's going on right now. And I remember I was on a G-Chat with Jordan, and he just messaged me. We were already having a conversation, but he just messaged me, you know, Edgar Wright left Ant-Man. I went, oh, what? And I was surprised for about 5 seconds. And then I thought, oh, yes, I know exactly why this happened. And then, sure enough, I look at the story in Variety, and it says that they left because of creative differences. And this is where, of course, the issue of the artist comes in. And, to be honest, I was actually sort of quietly relieved when this news came, because I really, you know, as we've talked about on the show, I really love the films of Edgar Wright, and I think that he is one of, if not the most significant voices in film comedy today, at least working. And when he was attached to something like this, I was always concerned that it would become sort of this homogenized thing that's part of their house style, the Marvel house style, basically.
Right.
Or, at the very least, he would have to put in... Because his films are very meticulously scripted. And I thought to myself, well, is he going to have to put in something about, you know, S.H.I.E.L.D. or different Avengers or things like that? Is he going to have to shoehorn those elements in? Which has happened in the past, where these sorts of films were written one way, and then they are reworked, and then they're... shaped up to be a bit more correct as far as the Marvel quote unquote vision goes. And that's basically apparently what happened here. I believe every word of that story without knowing any of the details. That's not always, in fact, it's often not a safe thing to do. But I think it's telling that in this case, A, when the news came in, I thought to myself, oh, well, I know exactly what happened, or I can at least guess exactly what happened. And then when I hear a news story purporting what happened, it's very easy to believe. Really, the way I feel is that, you know, I just feel bad for the guy because he's working on it for, like, about half of his professional career, and now it's gone. But I also feel like, you know, it was his decision, and it's hard not to respect that, to step away from what would surely be the biggest movie of his career.
Yeah.
And I guess also, yeah, I mean, really what I just think now is, well, I'll have to wait a little longer for his next film, whatever that ends up being. But the upside is that it'll probably be more true to his vision. I'd rather wait an extra year or two for one of his own films,
right,
than get something compromised right away.
You'd rather see his vision on the screen than see his name on the screen.
Oh yeah, there's no question about it. And apparently they've hired some kind of replacement. I don't know who it'll be. Honestly, I feel kind of bad for the actors in the film because...
Right, because they came on... Because they're like, oh, sweet, I get to work with Edgar Wright.
Oh, yeah, I definitely think that was part of it. And the idea of Edgar Wright directing Paul Rudd as a ant-sized man, I mean, that's very exciting to me, personally. and I imagine, you know, a lot of people felt that way, too. So it really, it's like, it's not good for anybody. I think the only one who comes away from this looking good is Wright himself, but he's also probably getting the worst side of the deal, ultimately. So it's... Yeah, it's an unfortunate piece of business.
I was going to say that for me, there was... I mean, I don't know Ant-Man. I know that he can shrink to the size of an ant, which seems like it could be a useful power in very specific situations. But Edgar Wright has shown that he has a penchant for action scenes that are very inventive and very fun and very kinetic. And I was sure that he could do something with that that I probably wouldn't be able to think of and I'd find enjoyable. Because even when I don't like his films entirely, I feel like he's got an inventiveness to him that I can at least admire. You know, some of the fights in Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, the bathroom fight scene in The World's End. I mean, things like that, they're great. And at the same time that I really couldn't give a shit about what Marvel's doing, I did feel this weird kind of... pride or like happiness when I heard that he left, because there was just a part of me that said to myself, like, thank God that there is someone who can resist the siren song of this money and this publicity and will just like maintain their integrity, I guess. Not that everyone who's ever made a superhero film is sold out, but they do seem like the unstoppable juggernaut, and if you're offered one, obviously you're going to take it. And so it was just, I don't know, there was some little part of me that's like, you know what, Edgar, we don't always see eye to eye, but you're good people. And so I really like that about it. I'm less enthusiastic about the movie than I was before he left, but I mean, who gives a shit? It's Ant-Man.
Yeah. Brian, I might want to jump in there just
for a quick second.
I think... I disagree with you on one point. I feel like Iron Man 3 really stands out as a Shane Black film. You know, I mean, I don't think if it had given to another director, it would have had the same tone, you know, which was kind of like half caring about the fact that we're a superhero movie and half not caring, you know. I mean, certainly more than like the original Iron Man film, it was definitely more an auteur film than, you know, any of the others that I've seen so far.
That is true. That is true. I will give you that. I mean, as a fan of Shane Black's other films, I can definitely say that it's one of the lesser of his works, but I mean, he did still manage to get some of himself in there. Because he had a lot to do with the script of that, too, right?
I believe so, yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's funny, because you watch, you know, if you watch Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and Iron Man 3, you know, back to back, I mean, I feel like you see a lot of similarities, especially in the tone, and a lot of that might just be Robert Downey Jr. Being Robert Downey Jr., but I don't know. I felt like I walked out of Iron Man 3 and I said, okay, well, you know, they definitely have, like, almost a formula for these films, but they're still letting these directors, like, sneak in bits of themselves, like you said.
I think that for that movie, though, a lot of that did have to do that it was Robert Downey Jr. and it was Shane Black, and he did work on the script. And that movie felt a lot less connected to the mythology that they'd built up. And I think a lot of that was on purpose. But for this, it would be like Edgar Wright starting a new thing, like striking out on his own. And it just feels like maybe Shane Black was more willing to take notes, but was still able to work it in. Because it's a very simple preset character that you don't have to do a lot of build in for.
Totally.
He's already established in the world. I mean, it's the same type of thing. Has anyone watched a James Gunn movie?
No. Right? I don't think I have really any familiarity.
Silence.
With
him. I mean, he's doing Guardians of the Galaxy, and those trailers look fun, but that's another one of those things where I feel like it's so disconnected that it doesn't quite matter. And I think Marvel's like just thrown their hands up for that one. They just don't really give a shit as long as it makes money. It's just another way to get one of those damn, I was going to say Chaos Emeralds, but that's Sonic the Hedgehog. What are they called? Oh, the Infinity Gems into this. So, I mean, I don't know. I just don't know. But it is disheartening to hear that Edgar Wright has left, because it does kind of confirm your worst suspicions about it.
Totally. I think it does make you wonder, like, what could have possibly gone down where, you know, you have such a talented guy who obviously always has such a clear vision, you know, for his films, and to have him walk away after all that time. I mean, the producers must have been trying to do something pretty low.
Yeah.
Like, the script must have deteriorated drastically from what he originally conceived.
Danny King, any thoughts?
Yeah, I would say I'm mostly in line with what's been said. I feel like it's good that Edgar Wright is moving on if that's what he feels best, but it would be a totally different thing if, like, right after The World's End came out, he said, I'm going to try something new and try to make a Marvel movie. And then a few months later, he said, it's not working out. But for it to have been gestating for 8 years is a little bit, it's kind of a lot to take in, just because if we never see any of what he was thinking in that 8 years or any of the ideas he have, that's just like a lot of creative energy of his to be lost, kind of. So that's a little bit disappointing. But I feel like whatever he goes on to do next will be more in his control. And then the only other thing I would add is that I thought Jordan had a pretty insightful tweet on the Twitter.com when he said that it's telling that Marvel's final parting statement in the press release is that Ant-Man's release date is not impacted, which I thought was a pretty good thing to point out, because not only does that make it seem like they're invested in their release date, but it also downplays kind of what sort of value they put in Wright. Because basically, for the last sentence in a press release, you're like, okay, what's going to reassure our fans that we're making good movies and we're going to put everything we have into them? It's not that, you know, we admire Wright and we wish him luck in the future. It's that our movie is still coming out on this Friday in whatever year. Feel like buy your tickets in advance.
So it just seems more of a product. It's like if Apple suddenly had to get glass from a different place, and they're like, don't worry, the date of the iPhone is still going to be the same.
Right. Yeah. And I just imagine like the mindset of someone who does see all the Marvel movies reading that and they get to the end and they're just like, oh, sweet. Like, same date. But, yes, that's the only other thing I'd add.
All right. Well, any final thoughts to throw onto this bonfire of intellect before we move into our review of X-Men Days of Future Past?
One last thing I would say is I really don't remember the last time any piece of superhero movie news in my Twitter feed got that sort of reaction, really. any of any kind. And I think that's just kind of telling as to how much interest in this movie depended upon its director.
Yeah.
Which is really, I mean, we've kind of already said this, but it bears repeating that that is really an anomaly for this sort of thing. I think the last, I mean, you know, occasionally this stuff comes in and it's always kind of irritating because it's like, oh, they announced the title for, you know, Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice or something. And people make fun of it for about 25 minutes.
And then it gets old. And then the articles come out that are like Twitter's reaction to the
right,
name
yeah.
of the...
Exactly, but this.
I'll admit, I got in on that. I made a tweet that utilized every single character, and was basically a reference to Moby Dick. And needless to say, I got no retweets.
it's just, again, it's one of those things where I think a lot of people like myself would sort of, you know, we were already kind of willing to put this above the Marvel fray, you know. We were already willing to think of it as something extra special. And with the exception of them using some form of the script he wrote with Joe Cornish, with the exception of that, it's pretty much gone.
Yeah.
in like a heartbeat. It's just kind of gone. And now when Ant-Man comes out, basically what everyone is going to be saying in July 2015 is, well, this movie isn't very good. I wonder how it would have been if they let the guy make his own movie.
They were talking about like a difference in visions, and everyone on Twitter was like, hey, Marvel, we don't give a shit about your vision. We were queuing up for Edgar's vision.
Yeah, it's just, it's shooting yourself in the foot. It's fascinating to observe, but also just kind of disheartening at the same time.
Yeah.
And I guess that's that.
Well, from one Marvel movie to the next, this week's review. And this will also give us an opportunity to talk about Gun for Hire directors, people that may not have a discernible vision or style. It is X-Men Days of Future Past, directed by Bryan Singer. This is starring, I mean, where do I begin? Like literally everyone who's ever been in an X-Men movie ever. We've got Hugh Jackman, obviously. Jennifer Lawrence, James McAvoy, Michael Fassbender, as well as Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen, and then just a shit ton of other people that I don't feel like naming right now. So, yeah. X-Men Days of Future Past, out in theaters now. Here's the trailer.
Professor?
You're gonna find this hard to believe.
I was sent here for you.
From the future?
50 years from now.
Could you give me that one more time, please?
Stay with me.
In the beginning, the Sentinels were just targeting mutants. Then they began targeting everyone. They've come a long way to guide us, to bring us together. The X-Men, we need your help.
Tell whoever it was that sent you. I'm busy.
The person who sent me was you.
So X-Men Days of Future Past is based off of one of the most, I'm just going to say this because I know a bunch of comic nerds and I know myself, one of the better known X-Men sagas, I guess. I would say it's kind of right up there with Dark Phoenix, which got botched in the third one. And X-Men Days of Future Past finds us in a very dystopian future where Sentinels, these giant mutant-killing robots, have basically left the world in tatters, and one of the X-Men must be sent back in time in order to try to change the course of events that led to this terrible future. It is, I will say at the outset, that it's an ambitious film that attempts something that is oddly admirable just because of the near Sisyphean effort that it would take to actually do well. But let's see what we thought of it. So, Joe, you're the guest. Let's let you go first.
Oh, man. I actually liked it a lot, to tell you the truth. I wouldn't say I loved it, but, you know, I think the last really good X-Men movie that, you know, I really, really enjoyed was probably X-Men 2.
Wait, you didn't like First Class?
You know, First Class was good. I liked it, I think, because it was different, you know? And I mean, after The Last Stand, like, I mean, you know, anything would have been better.
You say that, but do you remember X-Men Origins Wolverine?
No, I didn't even see it.
Right,
so that's,
there you go.
Yeah, so you might be right. So I guess that would be would probably be even worse, because I watched the trailer and I just couldn't even bring myself to check it out. You know, and then I know a lot of people liked the last Wolverine movie. Unfortunately, I missed that one too.
Oh man, the Wolverine was great.
See, yeah, that's what I've heard. Connor O'Donnell, who another film stage person, he tries to tell me that the Wolverine was like fantastic, and the first, you know, two thirds are excellent, and it's really only the last act where things kind of, you know, get a little cliche as far as superhero movies go. You know, I didn't even know if it was fair to it would be fair to compare this type of movie to, you know, the Wolverine, because I feel like they were trying to do something so much bigger, yeah. You know. So, but I mean, you know, so the last X-Men movie I really liked was, you know, a Bryan Singer directed X-Men movie where they had a whole bunch of characters, and it, you know, it was just like there was an emphasis on story over action. And I was interested to see whether or not in Days of Future Past they would do something similar, because, you know, superhero movies have gotten so much bigger than they were, you know, when X-Men 2 came out. I mean, you know, you can't go see a superhero movie these days without at least like 13 explosions every 3 minutes. Like, you know, Captain America, the Winter Soldier, you know, I mean, as I like that movie too, but, you know, at some point I was like, okay, I'm watching, you know, people running through a crumbling building, and oh, here comes a giant ship that's going to, like, you know, blow a whole bunch of shit up again. You know, it's definitely like, even watching it, and even as much as I enjoyed like certain parts of it, I still very much felt like, okay, I've seen this before, you know, in the Avengers or in Iron Man 3 or, you know, name any of them really. So I thought it was interesting in Days of Future Past when it wasn't necessarily explosion after explosion. You know, there was definitely a deeper focus on the characters. And even though that kind of, I don't know, it didn't always work, or like, you know, there was still some of the dialogue that you've heard like a million times before. I guess it was just refreshing to see something like attempt to focus on story again over, you know, how many times like Magneto can crush, like, you know, the Golden Gate Bridge. So, and, you know, I mean, everyone in it was enjoyable too. You know, I mean, Hugh Jackman is always good at this role, you know, so it was great to see him like seem like he was enjoying himself again. You know, James McAvoy is like a lot of fun. I mean, watching him shoot up essentially, you know, what was like future heroin was kind of interesting. I was like, oh, I guess we're not making this for kids anymore, because this man is addicted to a liquid substance he's now injecting in his arm.
He was still in character from Filth. They had to ease him out of it pretty slowly.
But no, it was cool. You know, I mean, I don't know. I feel like as much as, you know, these films have like struggled in the past to, I think, live up to like the rest of the Marvel films, you know, this one actually did a nice job of like still being kind of interesting and adult without like, you know, resulting to so much blowing up. I mean, and the, you know, the friggin' the Sentinels were legitimately like kind of scary, which was really cool. Because they could have made them super cartoonish, and they gave them that like morphing ability, and I didn't really expect that. So yeah, no, that was nice. I mean, really the only person in these films who I kind of, it's confusing to me how like out of place they feel is Jennifer Lawrence. And like, I don't know if that's because they're not giving her a lot to do, or, you know, but like you watch her in other films and it's like, wow, she's, you know, really fucking good. And then you watch her even in First Class and it's, I don't know, everything seems kind of forced, but that might just be me. I'm not sure.
I liked her in First Class. I will say that the problem with a character like Mystique is that you get an actress like Jennifer Lawrence to latex paint her body blue, and the impulse is to have her on screen as often as possible.
Sure.
Which
Rebecca
means...
Romijn, I mean, holy shit, right?
But I mean, the problem with that is she has the morphing ability to be literally anyone she wants. And so she'll break into a secure area as like the head of that area. And then just because no one is within sight except for the camera and the audience that is us, she'll change into her blue self. not even
just,
like
just for fun,
right,
like,
not even like a human version of herself. It's like, guys, we paid Jennifer Lawrence a couple million dollars to paint herself blue and be naked. You think we're just not going to do that? Just because she's in some guy's office doesn't mean she's going to keep looking like him, because that's the safer choice for her character. so stuff like that kind of annoys me at times. But I will say that, yeah, especially in this movie, she seems a little out of place, though that might have more to do with the plot and all of the retconning they're attempting to do than mm-hmm. anything else. But Danny King, what did you think about X-Men Days of Future Past?
Yeah, well, I agree on some of the confusion with the Jennifer Lawrence role, because that's just such an awkward character to have, like, this incredibly famous actress play, like, this person who can morph into other people. Like, watching her first scene where she's, like, the army lieutenant or whatever is just such an odd experience, because she's this officer for the whole scene, and then it changes back to Jennifer Lawrence, and you're like, oh, cool, like, great performance, except that wasn't you scene, so can't wait to see the next scene.
That also makes no sense, because she's in the middle of Vietnam, and while she's mm-hmm. walking away from a plane in the middle of an army base where there's still a lot of people around,
changes back.
She changes into a woman still in army uniform. It's like, why? We get it. We knew she was Jennifer Lawrence. We didn't need her to do that for us.
Maybe
I'm the only person who notices and cares, but like, that stuff bugs me, because that's such an obvious, we're paying for Jennifer Lawrence, we gotta have Jennifer Lawrence.
I mean, you almost wonder if it might be a contract stipulation on her
end.
She
has to have,
like,
a certain amount of screen time.
Like, it has to be my real face for at least like 30 seconds in this 2.5-hour movie, or something weird like that.
I think there'd be nothing more awesome than getting paid to be in a movie and then being a shapeshifter, so you literally don't have to be in the movie at all. Just like, yeah, Mystique, Jennifer Lawrence, all those other people, Jennifer Lawrence, technically.
Yeah, the only other weird thing about her is, I don't know, she, and I think it's just like, you know, the way she looks. She doesn't really ever feel as dangerous as, you know, Rebecca Romijn felt, you know, in X-Men 2. I don't know. It might just
be a plot reason for that. I mean, this is supposed to be her, like, Anakin Skywalker moment, you know?
Definitely.
So there's that. Danny, any further thoughts beyond Jennifer Lawrence as a problem?
No, that was pretty much all I had. So yeah, I was a little bit more mixed on the film, but I agree that the sort of lack of consistent action set pieces was sort of refreshing. Because as someone who's not too steeped in, like, X-Men mythology, the first 10 or 15 minutes of this movie was just sort of kind of a blob of action that I didn't really understand.
Yeah.
Basically, anything in the Ellen Page timeline could have been in, like, a foreign language from my perspective. But, like,
that
once
been
it...
amazing.
That would have been
That's
interesting.
That's how far in the future it is.
But yeah, I mean, once it flashes back to, like, this pre-Watergate era, and Hugh Jackman is sort of waking up in this room with a girl he doesn't know and fighting people with wooden claws.
They're bone.
Bone claws, sorry.
The bone claws are a huge point of contention in the comic book world.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I don't know why I know so much about X-Men, but apparently the Weapon X program was supposed to have given him his claws because he could survive the claws constantly ripping out of his skin. And at some point in one of the prequel comics they made, someone gave him bone claws. And so the metal is overlaid over the claws. And that's like a huge point of contention. Like, some people hate the bone claws because it's like, why would he have that? But again, you know, why would any of these people have anything? Like, what do genes have to do with the ability to create portals? I don't know.
I'm disappointed that wasn't in the film. There were a few scenes talking about the claws.
Well, I'm sure if you watched X-Men Origins Wolverine, but who would want to do that to themselves? But him waking up.
Basically, out of that. Once it just gets into that timeline, it seemed to me like the energy level picked up and the actors seemed more into what they were doing. Although, I mean, part of it does lose steam for me because so much of the dialogue is kind of expository and hinting at these past relationships. And part of it almost felt like the first episode of, like, the fifth season of a TV show where you're just kind of watching to see your favorite characters in their classic situations, just being themselves and just getting enjoyment out of that, which is fine if that's what you're into. But again, as someone who's not particularly steeped in this mythology, it's not that interesting for me to watch. Although I have read some interesting defenses of the film that are kind of supporting it for that very reason, for kind of being this unusually, it's sort of a big budget movie that's unusually not accommodating to like novice viewers.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's sort of an interesting argument just because the movie did cost like $250 million, which is insane. Especially for a movie that, like we said, has less action than you might expect. But for me personally, just a lot of the inside baseball interactions and stuff like that, I couldn't really get into. So overall, I would say I was pretty mixed. Although, like Brian mentioned, I did enjoy The Wolverine, so I'll just throw that out there to remind people that I'm not anti X-Men.
All right, Nick Newman, what about yourself?
Well, it's weird that this movie cost $250 million because this is one of the first, if not the first, movies I've seen that throughout kind of looked like an HD television with true motion set on.
That same 48 frames per second kind of thing.
I don't know if you guys noticed, but the cinematography in this movie I thought was really quite bad. It stood out just really like a sore thumb, and it's sort of appropriate because this came about 24 hours after Quentin Tarantino held a press conference at Cannes where he criticized digital projection as being like television in public. Mm-hmm. And that was on my mind as I was watching this movie, to say nothing of the fact that, you know, it feels just sort of very inconsequential, like a pilot episode. I think there's the template for a good movie in the 30 to 45 minutes that aren't completely embarrassing for everybody involved. I think that, you know, this is, as I tweeted, this is sort of like the first movie I've ever seen where it feels like every actor is making a cameo, kind of.
Yeah.
Because you have so many actors who have so many speaking parts, and their characters ostensibly play an important part in the plot, and yet it feels like they're barely in it. I mean, you have Michael Fassbender, who is probably the best English language actor of his generation, if just not the best actor of his generation, period. Who is doing... Is that a controversial opinion?
No, it's just bold. Shocking.
It's just weird. I mean, like, I could agree with you, but it's still weird that someone said that out loud.
Oh, okay.
You know, you usually tend away from hyperbole or making definite statements.
Well, the thing is, he's excellent in his short period in this movie, but even then, so much of this performance just requires him to glare and extend his hand. And
I will say he's better at glaring and extending his hand than Ian McKellen.
I might disagree with that.
What?
I think Ian McKellen has elevated the glaring and pointing his hand an absolute art form. I feel something every time he does it.
But he was...
he can feel the history of the character.
He was absolutely the standout of First Class, no questions asked. And
as he was meant to be, I believe.
I remember when X-Men First Class 2, as it was at the time, began developing, they said it was going to be more Magneto-centric. And that got me very excited, because that's exactly what you're supposed to do when you have Michael Fassbender playing this character. And then he's in this movie, but it feels like he's barely in it. He has barely any presence whatsoever.
Right.
James McAvoy has some, I guess, but even then, the movie just flits back and forth between all these characters so often, and the future or present day segment is again embarrassing because
I agree 100%.
You have this thing where this is not fucking Intolerance, okay? This is not a D.W. Griffith movie where the intercutting is necessary. There is no reason to spend all the money and resources it took to do those future scenes when the entire action is contingent upon what is happening in the past. Because if you stop what's happening in the past, what happens in the future will not actually happen. It's like the Terminator rule, basically, right?
Right.
So it's so clear that they just did this so that you could have... A, so you could have an action scene that you could put in trailers and you could make Sentinel toys and whatnot. But also, so you could have Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart come back. But then you have them come back and they have, what, one exchange of dialogue, maybe, toward the very end?
Yeah.
And it's just... it's really frustrating, and it's frustrating in a way that I wouldn't expect because I don't really care about X-Men, but I feel like X-Men has an advantage because it has all of these good actors, and it even kind of looks like they give a shit, too. and that, you know, that elevates it above a lot of other comic book movie franchises, I think. And in this case, they're just kind of there. And, I mean, it's also there's something very presumptuous about it. Like, you know, when Halle Berry's Storm comes back, like, does anybody give a shit that she's back in the role? I mean, it's this sort of thing where
You're telling me you haven't missed Halle Berry's Storm?
Since 2006's X-Men The Last Stand, I've been pining. But I just, you know, the word I keep using is embarrassing. I felt embarrassed for myself watching this movie at times, honestly, because I felt like it was just one of those things where I just thought, you know, what are we doing here? Why are we watching this? This is such a nothing. And what's worse about it is that there are like 30 to 45 good minutes in this movie, and there are good ideas, and there are good performances, and there are actually good individual scenes. The scene with Evan Peters's Quicksilver,
yeah,
where you see his powers in full effect, will probably be one of my favorite scenes in any movie I see this year, honestly. And it's weird to say that about a film I'm being so negative about, but that was a really impressive piece of work, and it basically took all of the concepts and it took all of the advantages that you have as a storyteller, speaking visually, I suppose, as a visual storyteller when these concepts are at play, and it utilized them. It was a really, really good scene, and then the character just goes away because right. There's no need for him anymore.
But that's ridiculous. There is still a need for his character. You have a character who basically stopped time, and you're trying to stop an assassination attempt,
mm-hmm.
and you don't, like, they didn't even give a reason. It's not like, oh, I'm on probation and I can't leave the country or I'll go to jail, which would be a shit reason anyway, because you can basically stop time.
I think it was because, you know, oh yeah, I have to go film the new season of American Horror Story.
Of course.
Basically. But no, exactly. I mean, one of the most pivotal scenes in the movie involves an attempted assassination. If you just had him there, I mean, it involves firing a gun. If you just had him there, the scene would be over. The movie would end in 15 minutes approximately. You know, you think about it in that scene, there's this moment where Wolverine, who I guess he is really the only main character in the film, which makes sense because everybody likes Wolverine and, you know, he's always been the linchpin of the series. But you have this moment where it seems like he loses his memory and it seems like this is going to be a really major part of the film and then it's not. He loses his memory for about 3 minutes.
Well, he doesn't lose his memory. His present consciousness,
yes,
and comes back, which there's a really weird existential question in this, because he goes back in time but only through his mind. So like Kitty Pryde, Ellen Page's character, whose only power that we've seen so far is that she can go through things, somehow has the ability to project people's consciousnesses back. Like, so if your body remains but your mind, all your mind things go into your brain when you're younger, and that helps because suddenly you're like, oh shit, we got some stuff going on, we gotta stop it. I will accept that. Why Xavier couldn't do that, because he is specifically a mind power guy, I don't understand. But I mean,
I think I didn't read the original comic, but I know in the original comic, it's her character that has the ability to, like, do this mind, like, body transfer nonsense.
Well,
and Does she actually go back?
I thought there was a huge, like, question, because in the, like, comic, I think she goes back, and they're like, well, why are you making it Wolverine? Is it because he's, like, a male character that everyone likes? There was a big question about it from a feminist perspective, and a whitewashing perspective, and all the other stuff you'd expect. And I think that the screenwriter's answer was, we need someone who looks the same in 1972 and like 20, whenever the fuck.
Totally. Totally. And that makes sense to me. I mean, to that end, if they change that, then why not make it, you know, Xavier who does the mind meld too, and just cut Kitty Pryde out altogether. I mean, who knows?
Yeah. But anyway, yeah. Nick, you were saying, like, he unsynchronizes, so his anyway.
One thing I really liked about this movie, one of the few things I really liked about this movie, though, is the way it dispenses with concerns regarding continuity. Basically how there was that scene at the end of the Wolverine, like the mid-credit scene, which kind of shows that for some reason Professor X is back alive, right? And right, now he and Magneto are allies. Yeah, they never actually explained why he comes back to life. But I kind of like that. I don't know. I sort of like that this movie just kind of starts and that stuff is in place. You don't really have to worry about it because a lot of this movie, most of this movie is in some way inconsequential. But I think that this is one of the moments where they actually acknowledge some inconsequentiality in comic book storytelling. To me, it kind of replicated the feeling of when I was a kid and I would pick up a X-Men comic in like Barnes & Noble or something and just start reading it. Mm-hmm. I thought it actually did a good job of replicating that.
See, I only ever watched the cartoon when I was a kid.
Okay. See, you know, I think that
I can still hum the theme to that cartoon.
See, to me, it seems pretty clear that they had planned to just make this. I mean, it was sort of in development. They had planned to originally make this a First Class sequel, and then they kind of thought, let's find a way to bring back, you know, maybe a way to sort of drum up a little more interest, because I know X-Men First Class wasn't, domestically, it wasn't as big a hit as they were expecting. So I think that...
Which is bullshit.
It seems to me like this was probably just a way to, again, shoehorn it in, and maybe their thought was, let's just go with it, let's just jump in. To that I say, okay.
See, okay, so I've said a lot without really saying what my opinion is. This movie, I guess, is okay. In the same way that if you'd never seen an episode of Game of Thrones before, and you watched, like, a mid-second season episode, that would be okay. Like, I can kind of understand everything, and, you know, I guess I can figure out the stakes. But here's my problem. This is a movie that's a crossover between two different film series that definitely needed at least one more installment for this movie to have the impact that it thinks it's having. Like, from the original X-Men series, you need some at least one other film after The Last Stand to bring in the Sentinel program and, like, show us the degradation of the world. Because in that movie, everything is pretty much fine. And in this movie, literally everyone is dead. And then it's the same thing with First Class. It's like in that movie, everything is fine. And then you find out that a bunch of the characters have basically just been written out and they've jumped forward 10 years. And you find out all of this other stuff and there's all these allusions to things that have happened in between that are, you know, kind of spoilery. But like, there's not enough. Like, I really liked First Class. I was looking forward to more, you know, swinging 60s kind of spy, you know, early era James Bond mashed up with a superhero film. More of that. Give me that. I was excited because no other superhero films are doing that. And then they basically changed it so that it's like the plot of the first X-Men film grafted onto the 70s. So I just didn't give a shit. I just couldn't care. And like, you know, you jump from the end of The Last Stand, which, you know, was not a great movie by any stretch of the imagination. And then you go to this, where suddenly everyone's in, like, weird future armor, and these crazy metamorphizing sentinels are trying to kill everyone. And they keep talking about how bad it is. And yeah, it looks pretty bad, but it would have been great if I could have seen that war at the outset and gotten that sense of hopelessness rather than just have everyone mull around saying, oh man, it's pretty bad right now, isn't it? There's definitely a film missing on both ends. And this would be the Avengers style film that is really light on character work, but at least, you know, moves the plot forward and gives us what we were building towards. Like, they didn't bother building towards this. They just made it happen.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. I mean, you know, Fox must be looking at what the Marvel films are doing and saying to themselves, wow, are we missing out on a lot of money?
Oh, yeah. It's the same thing that WB is doing with the Batman Roman numeral 5 Superman Dawn of Justice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
you're moving way too fast.
Yeah. Well, I feel
gotta slow down.
Right. I feel like they're trying to play catch up, you know, and I'm sure that, you know, a lot of the back, you know, the business decisions are all about that. It's about, you know, trying to compete with like these Marvel movies that every single one of them now makes $1 billion, you know, in the long run. And then they do, they're going to have another big Avengers film. Like, I don't know if you're thinking about it from like a tentpole, I think they realized very quickly that they needed to get their like Marvel franchise in order. And, you know, I was actually, that's why I was kind of surprised that there was so, you know, there wasn't a lot of action in this film, because I really thought it was going to try to be their answer to the Avengers, and it definitely isn't. Definitely isn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does not fill that gap. So, I mean, was I bored? No, but the movie at some point I realized felt like it was just really disjointed. Whereas I could watch First Class and feel the sweep of the narrative and enjoy the music, and there's a sense of like discovery, and like the thing that I love about the X-Men is that even though I make fun of them all the time for like what in your genes suddenly gives you the ability to shoot light beams out of your eyes, like, you know, it's, when they're sticking to like animal stuff or like biological stuff, like Wolverine regenerating, fine, I'll pick up on that, that's great. Telekinesis, sure, but like manipulating the weather, like that doesn't make any sense, but you know what, it's great, I don't mind, because you've come up with a stupid reason to have a bunch of people with powers that can surprise you. You know that first attack with the Sentinels when Blink, is that her name?
I have no idea.
The cute girl who can throw portals, like that's good stuff. Like I loved that, and I wasn't expecting that to happen, because anyone could have any power at all. It's great. I love being surprised like that. This movie, they just, like, outside of her, everyone was the same, and it was just all, like, there wasn't that moment, like, in First Class where the girl seems to have wing tattoos, and then they fold up and she has actual wings. Like, that was interesting. That was cool. It just annoys me. I don't know. I really liked First Class, and I'm bummed out that all of the good stuff that I saw coming from that was then subsumed by the Singer verse and has now been retconned. And I don't even know what movie we're going to get as a sequel. Like, I walked out of the theater, and usually you know you're going to get a sequel. It's not a spoiler to say, hey, sequels are probably coming to this. But I don't know what time it's going to be in. Nothing makes sense to me anymore. I feel like this movie retroactively destroyed 3 to 5 movies worth of stuff, and now they're just like, hey, get ready, because it's all just going to happen again.
Well, who was that that they teased at the end after the credits? Was that Apocalypse? I don't even know.
Yeah, that was Apocalypse.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess.
Spoiler? I don't know if that's a spoiler. It doesn't have anything to do with the movie.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
It
literally takes place, it seems like, 5,000 years before the movie. And everyone knows that the next one is X-Men Apocalypse.
Yeah.
They've already announced that like a year ago. So I think that's fine. But yeah, that's Apocalypse.
That's good. You just, the new guy blew it. You can just blame it on me.
Yeah, that's
the special guest, rather.
Rookie error.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Speaking of spoilers, do we need spoilers? Like, does anyone...
Because like the only moments where, you know, there's supposed to be, you know... because, you know, you have a character die, you have like a major character die, and then at the end it's, oh no, it's fine.
Yeah, because the future's changed.
I will say that I don't know if this is a spoiler, but I actually really did think they were going to kill off Wolverine. And then, of course, they didn't. But because you have to have the franchise that's supposed to pop the character back, I will give the movie credit for thinking up a good way to actually kill him, or at least...
Yeah, that was brutal.
Yeah, that was nuts.
Yeah.
And I think that...
But he's like... I guess... You know what? Let's just say... Okay, Nick, is what you were going to say, is it not going to be a spoiler? Or is should we just throw up the warning?
What I was going to say is that... I'll just say it. I thought that was a really good way to demonstrate the young Magneto as a villain, because the movie, I think, really kind of blunders with that sort of development, where... He spends a lot of the movie sort of as like an uneasy ally slash, you know, occasional traitor. But it's also sort of this uncomfortable thing where, yes, we've seen him older as a villain, but I think his development into a villain from his development into a villain from a young age to where he's Ian McKellen doesn't really seem to be very clear as established in these movies, because again, he spends a lot of the movie kind of like going with them for a bit, and then he disappears, and then he comes back and suddenly he's bad again. And I don't know, it just sort of felt like it was picking up directly from the end of the last film, but not actually continuing it much further. Because if you think about it, the climax of this movie is really quite similar to the climax of X-Men First Class. It's sort of the same idea.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of, I mean, I don't know. It's just, it's not interesting after 14 years.
Well, that, the
same thing.
I was going to say, the every X-Men film, their thing is, like, they're never fighting someone. It's always like, we have to either kill the humans or get them to accept us when we save them. That's literally it. All the time. Mm-hmm. Forever. Like, that's all. And so, at the end of First Class, it was an interesting concept that you would have, you know, mutants blamed for an attack, and then they stopped the attack, and then when they had the ability to take vengeance, they didn't. And that would cause an interesting, you know, questioning in popular culture, like friend or foe, like, can we trust all of them? And then at some point you would hope that people would realize, but, you know, I guess stereotypes and continued racism and everything has proven that this isn't true. That just because a group of people share a similar trait doesn't mean they're all the same. So that's interesting, and that's another thing that the X-Men can give to the cinematic world as far as superhero films. Because in every other film, people are like full-on heroes. You know, you never, outside of like a couple of scenes in Iron Man 2, where they're talking about his suit as a weapon and basically having a gun control debate and private industry debate. No one ever questions whether or not Captain America is evil. And in this, you get that. You have that ability because it's not a superhero. It's a class of people who have abilities that others don't.
Mm-hmm.
And we lose that. And then, like you said, the movie ends in a similar way. Like, mutants nearly bring everyone to the brink of destruction. And then mutants pull us back. And at some point, it really just starts to feel like human beings have no agency.
Well, yeah, it's funny. And until you brought that up, Brian, I never really thought much about it. But I guess, you know, at the end of The Dark Knight, where, you know, Batman agrees to, like, be framed for, you know, Harvey Dent's murder, or even in Man of Steel, you know, where the human characters don't know if they trust Superman yet. Like,
yeah.
I didn't even realize it, but I mean, I feel like you do see that in other films, you know, but it's, I guess, not as much of a central point to the characters as it is in the X-Men movies.
Yeah.
You know?
Like in the X-Men movies, it really is a deeper societal question, and it's not about one person. It's about a group of people. I mean, if you think about most of the Marvel films, like Godzilla from last week's Godzilla movie has more of an ambiguous arc than most of the Marvel characters. And I say I'm a huge fan of that movie, and that's actually one of the things I liked most about it, was this question at the end of, like, is he evil, is he good, or is he just a chaotic neutral?
Mm.
But, yeah, I mean, so, you know, I don't know. I can't. I just, like, this movie.
Yeah.
It so just felt like a throwback. It felt like the sequel to X-Men The Last Stand that no one really wanted. Like, I was fine with them just going to First Class.
Did they bring back Kelsey Grammer at the end?
Yes, they did.
They actually
what,
got
did,
him
and put
sat
him
in a chair.
I don't know. They might have had a body double and then just dubbed in his voice.
Oh, God.
Another one of those things where it's like, well, he's the blue guy now. Everyone's blue.
Did you know that Kelsey Grammer wrote a memoir called Grammar Lessons?
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I want to read that so bad.
Oh, my God. Why am I not reading that right now? I will say, Nick, you had mentioned the look of this film, and the cinematographer is the same guy who did Drive.
Oh, that's weird.
But that to me is the only... Well, he did Superman Returns, and the cinematography on that wasn't bad.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
it's
a prominent cinematographer.
Confessions of a Dangerous Mind he did. I mean, some of his films are really good, and then some of them I feel like he just walks in, slaps on like a mid-angle lens, and then just says, all right, I did my job.
I just, you know, it's surprising that nobody is talking about just how poor the film looks. I mean, I was kind of shocked. I thought that there was... I mean, did everyone else have the experience?
Some of the VFX looked really shoddy to me.
I mean, it was just... I kind of thought there was something wrong with the projection, honestly. Like, that's how crappy it looked. It looked like true motion, and I hate that.
I just had a lot of problems with some stylistic choices. Like, every time they cut to, like, a 16mm film that someone was shooting...
Yeah, they did like, that a lot.
They did it so much.
They did that a lot.
Yeah, I didn't like it. It didn't make sense to me. And then they showed the same footage on the news, and I guess maybe in their minds they're like, well, maybe all these people, you know, these 13-year-olds who don't know that there was such a thing as like a handheld video camera back then, we need to show them that.
Well, that was clearly shot with the iPhone 8mm app.
Like, oh, obviously.
That's what I was thinking
of.
But,
good enough to be...
$250 million film, we're definitely shooting it with the iPhone 5S.
Look, we're not going to waste the time and the development fees. We're shooting this thing on an Alexa, so we're not using any photo processing. I was going to say something else that really bugged me about the future scenes was the repetition. Because is it just my mind, or did Sean Asmore, who plays Iceman, just have three different scenes where he's like, she can't keep doing this? I just, I don't know. Like that,
Can I change topic real quick?
I'll allow it.
Thank you, Judge. Peter Dinklage. How about Peter?
You know, he was there.
He's okay. Oh. I was a little disappointed there wasn't better Peter. I really was, because I love him on Game of Thrones.
I don't know why he had to be the guy. Like, that's... You'd think if you got Peter Dinklage, you'd give him something to do.
I thought he was fine.
He just continuously walks up to people and is like, mutants are bad. I've got a weapon.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought he captured a certain... kind of like Tyrion Lannister. I thought he captured a certain
Tyrion
brilliance mixed with undefeatable, or rather unquenchable smugness.
Did they give him a motivation?
He doesn't like mutants.
Yeah, and at some point he says, like, wouldn't it be great if for once we were united as a species?
Right.
Yeah, I feel like the strength of a lot of superhero movies could be judged off of, like, how good your villains are. And they definitely didn't give him enough to do, because I feel like they had too many villains between him and, like, young Magneto.
Magneto and then Mystique.
Yeah.
I mean, that ending scene is a nightmare, because I was just like, okay, you know what? Fuck it. Here's a spoiler warning. I'm going to talk about the climactic scene in the movie. So the climax of the movie is a little crazy. Magneto rips RFK Stadium out of the ground, puts it around the White House. He has already used railroad ties to reprogram / give a metal skeleton to the Sentinels that are otherwise a polymer that he can't control. And he basically takes the White House hostage, rips the presidential bunker out of the Oval Office, and is getting ready to straight up shoot everyone. And then,
when you describe it, it sounds really cool,
right?
But keep going.
And then Mystique uses a plastic gun, I don't know where she got it from, to shoot Magneto in the neck. And then she turns around and is going to shoot Trask. I mean, why that is still her primary objective, and if that was the case, why she would shoot Magneto is beyond me. Unless she was so committed to doing it herself, but if that was the case, why didn't she just do it already?
I think she was pissed that he shot her earlier.
Okay,
they attempt to explain why she would shoot him.
So it was like a tit for tat, even Stevens thing.
I shoot you, you shoot me.
Yeah.
We're all getting paid a lot of money to be here. I mean, you know.
But I mean, at that point, you've got Trask, ostensible bad guy. Mystique, ostensible worse guy, because if she kills Trask, things are going to get a lot worse in the future. So she's basically like the plot device. She's the Maltese Falcon that everyone's always trying to find and, you know, claim and, you know, work towards their end. So what I'm seeing at the end of this movie is that the world isn't going to demand a mutant killing robot, because after one mutant took the White House hostage and had the president and his chiefs of staff at gunpoint, one other mutant stopped said mutant, but then totally let him get away. Like, and maybe they're going to explain this more in other films, but like, it seems to me that that would be even more of a reason to have a Sentinel program. You go from, oh, there are these blue people on the streets and, you know, they appear to be harming one another, to they legitimately threatened the strongest nation on Earth and nearly caused a catastrophic loss of life and a massive power vacuum. And that's somehow going to make you feel safer? Just because one of them shoots the other one, then turns her gun, pauses for like 20 seconds, and then decides not to do anything? And then the uber bad guy flies away. Like, he's still out there. And I have a lot of problems with that, because I needed the movie to wrap up in a way that at least made sense, and it absolutely did not. Like, if she had said something to the cameras, you know, like, you know, just like you struggle with good and evil in your society, so do we struggle with it in ours, and then she left. Like, at least that would do something, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it was almost similar to the ending of X-Men 2, where, you know, it opens with that really cool scene of Nightcrawler, like, assassinate the president. Yeah, yeah. And then it ends with, once again, the mutants, like, you know, Charles Xavier giving some speech to the president about how not all mutants are bad and he shouldn't sign whatever that, I forget what the paperwork is he's about to sign.
Yeah.
But I feel like they did something similar in this film, where it was like, you know, once again, there's mutants trying to kill you and mutants trying to defend you, and you're just caught in the middle. And I think you're right. I mean, I don't know if that would be enough to, you know, realistically believe that then people would say, oh, no, okay, we won't build these giant robots that, you know, can kill them all. I mean, I guess, I mean, you know, never, you don't want to go down this road, but, like, how else do you wrap it up, you know?
I have no idea.
I mean, I guess there are a million ways, maybe.
That's why I said at the outset that it was a Sisyphean effort, and I think that they did the best they could.
I feel like I need to mention an actor named Mark Camacho.
Okay.
Who played Nixon. Thought it was an entertaining performance, and I'm finding his...
The tricky dick dual peace sign.
I didn't think it was a good Nixon.
Oh, I don't think it was a good Nixon.
You prefer Frank Langella or Anthony Hopkins?
You know what superhero movie did Nixon much better is Watchmen. That was a much better superhero movie, Nixon. And I couldn't help but compare the two. Really, they should have got Philip Baker Hall back from Robert Altman's Secret Honor. I don't know if anybody's seen that movie. Probably the best Nixon performance.
Did anyone else find it really weird? Okay, so did anyone else actually think it was Nixon when he walked out?
I have an important thing to bring up.
Okay.
Is that now, I do appreciate that Checkers is now technically part of the X-Men timeline. Checkers being Nixon's dog. who gets a couple of insert shots in the movie.
So when Nixon steps out and says, you know, you can shoot me, don't shoot these other people, was anyone like, this is probably the kindest that any pop culture has ever been to Nixon? And then get really upset when they realized it was Mystique. Because I think it would have been so much more awesome if they were like, you know what we're going to do? You know how we're going to be different? We're going to make Nixon a selfless hero.
That would have been fine.
I would have been down for that.
That would have been awesome.
Part of me wondered if this was going to be like Bryan Singer's comeback. And as much as I really did like the movie. As much as I liked it, I don't see it being, you know, something that's going to like bring him back to doing regular work that's actually decent.
Yeah, probably not. Yeah.
I know you guys aren't Singer fans, but you know, Usual Suspects was good, right? Right.
I watched that again the other week, and I enjoyed it.
I did enjoy the Bad Hat Harry production logo with the
Usual Suspects. The
is that new? Yeah. I feel like I haven't seen that before. That was kind of neat.
No, that's been on a few. You wouldn't have seen it. I think it was right in front of Jack the Giant Slayer.
Oh, okay. That's kind of weird.
Which I enjoyed more than this movie. So that's how I'm going to go out.
I did in my theater. I did have one person go, "Wow!" after the Bad Hat Harry logo finished.
Damn.
So that guy was really impressed by that logo.
Yeah, easy target.
Also, I don't know how your theaters were, but my theater was pretty into it.
Yeah,
my theater
was into it.
I had laughter and applause, and when Storm got that thing thrust through her, a bunch of people definitely gasped, which was kind of funny.
I thought you were going to say they cheered.
No, I was happy, but no one else was. They all seemed to be genuinely shocked that they killed Storm. Go figure.
I mean, at that point, I assumed from the outset that they were going to straight up butcher everyone, because, as Nick, you so succinctly put it, nothing matters.
Yeah.
Nothing in that future matters.
Yeah.
Any final thoughts on this before we wrap up, I guess?
No. Thank you guys for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Oh, we still got more shit to talk about. It's just
we do.
That movie.
Oh, great. I take it back then.
Oh, well, okay.
Still go wrong here.
So that's our thoughts on X-Men Days of Future Past. Passable fun while it's happening. Don't think about it too much afterwards. And that time in the bottle scene with Quicksilver, who I still can't believe they just were like, "All right, take it back our rental car, bitch." That's that. So let's talk about what's coming out to Blu-ray and DVD next week. We got a Blu-ray re-release of the Criterion editions of The Life Aquatic and Red River. We also have new films, Endless Love. And is that it for new film releases? That's pretty sad. Nick, did you end up going out to see Endless Love?
No, I didn't get around missed to it. Somehow.
Lame. All right. Well, other than that, just a bunch of Blu-ray re-releases or reissues. We got Sleepaway Camp.
Yeah.
Dracula.
Oh, you know what's one new release, actually, is Gambit, which is actually scripted by Joel and Ethan Coen.
Oh.
Great cover.
It was a fantastic cover. I'm looking at it right now.
Apparently, it's quite bad, and it was kind of... It came out in the UK, I think, at the end of 2011 or something, it came out a little while ago in the UK, and it was just released in the US about...
I was about to say, it was like a couple weeks ago. Yeah,
I think maybe in a couple of theaters and on iTunes. I'll see it because, you know, I'm a Coen Brothers completist, but I am not looking forward to it.
Yeah, no. So
wait, Brian, do you watch Jack Irish?
No, I really want to, though.
Oh, okay.
It's got
Guy Pearce. I remember someone mentioning that. Yeah.
We talked about it when they released season one or whatever, and now it seems like it's coming out again. So that's that. Sweet. Let's move forward. Coming to theaters, May 30th, we have Maleficent. The wickedization of the Sleeping Beauty mythos, I guess, with Angelina Jolie, Elle Fanning, and Charlton Copley.
Yeah.
Awesome. We also have the sophomore directorial effort from Seth MacFarlane, A Million Ways to Die in the West.
Mm-hmm.
Coming to limited release, we have Night Moves. Filth, which has been out on VOD, is getting its theatrical release in America. And then we got something called Coringall.
Mm-hmm.
Thoughts on any of these, gentlemen?
I've seen Night Moves, and I think it's very, very good. I'm a big Kelly Reichardt fan, so sort of her... I don't know if you guys have seen her other films, but to kind of see her go in a new direction while sticking to some of her very specific formal traits was exciting to me. It's a good film. I don't know if it's going to be on VOD. It's released by Cinedigium, who I don't... know if they normally do that, but that's a good movie, and I actually did an interview with her that'll be up on the site probably Tuesday or Wednesday, so by the time you're listening to this it might actually be up there.
Audio?
No, just a text interview.
Alright, I'm gonna say that this kind of sucks. Well, this actually will feed into our next segment. I just saw Filth. It's on Amazon and iTunes on one of those before it hits theaters thing, and that was going to be my recently watched.
Is it filthy?
It's quite filthy.
There's well, I would expect no more, no less.
Yes.
Of a film
called Phil.
Called Phil.
Starring James McAvoy. So that's
pretty
awesome.
That itself does not signal filthiness.
I mean, he was pretty fucking filthy in the X-Men film. Stringy ass hair and, you know, a heroin addict, basically. Anyway, so yeah, let's just leap into our thoughts on our recently watched selections. And for once, I will go first. I saw Filth. It's on VOD and coming to limited release. This is a movie based on the book by Irving Welsh, who did Trainspotting. And you can kind of tell, if you've seen any of the trailers, that they are hoping to capture that same Trainspotting energy. This movie is a little bit different than Trainspotting. I mean, it's still got Scottish people behaving badly, but it's a little more focused in its story and a little more crazy. But I enjoyed it. It was a pretty good movie. It's pretty I was going to say passable. It's not as impactful as I was hoping it would be, but I guess, you know, for someone looking for just more of that kind of crazy Irving Welsh, you know, humanist cynicism, and then just getting to see James McAvoy being weird, it worked. It filled it out really well. So yeah, it's a funny, crude film, and I enjoyed it. So I don't know if I would go to the theater to see it if it's on VOD and you're still looking for it.
strong recommendation here.
I enjoyed it, but it's frivolous, and it's not as, I mean, there are some twists and turns in it that are obviously meant to play much bigger than it's supposed to, and you're supposed to really delve into the psychology of this character, but it's so over the top that it's impossible to really get deep into it. But I will say that since I watched it on Wednesday and we're recording on Sunday, I have thought about it quite a bit, and there are a lot of admirable elements. So I would say anyone interested, definitely go out and see Filth or VOD it. I don't think that it gains anything by being on the big screen. So that's that. Joe, what's something you watched recently you think we should check out?
Does it have to be like a movie that people probably haven't seen, or can it be something
that... It can be whatever.
It can be whatever. I did watch 20 Feet from Stardom a couple days ago. Yeah.
That won the Oscar, didn't it?
It did. It's on Netflix streaming. And I thought it was excellent. I mean, if you love music, and especially if you love Motown, or, you know, really any songs that have backup singers in them in any capacity, it's a really, really fascinating film. And just, you know, I mean, as documentaries go, it looks sharp. You know, they got like the best people they could possibly get to do like that type of movie. You know, I mean, because backup singers, like, I mean, you know, if you ever think twice about them, it's only because they are either got super famous after they were a backup singer, or, you know, they died tragically of like some sort of drug overdose, and they also murdered 5 people before they did it. But otherwise, it was really great. And yeah, definitely recommend it.
All right. Danny King.
Yes. I was able to catch a print of Out of the Blue at BAM Cinematheque in Brooklyn. It's a 1980 film. That's one of the few films Dennis Hopper directed during his lifetime. And he originally just signed as an actor.
He's still alive, is he not?
He is not alive.
Dennis Hopper?
Dennis Hopper has left the building.
What? When the hell did that happen?
Like May of 2010.
Holy shit.
No, yeah. I thought he died recently.
No, it was May of 2010. I just looked it up.
No kidding.
What the fuck?
Holy
hell. How did I miss that?
Shit, man.
Where the fuck was I?
Sorry to
slow into my goddamn mind, Danny.
Wow.
Oh, guys, we gotta stop recording.
Yeah, also, we should have mentioned in our X-Men review that Hugh Jackman has been dead since 2003. anyway.
Yeah,
anyway,
so...
Anyway, you were saying...
I don't really know what to say. Yourself.
I don't know what to say either. I'm glad I already went,
so yeah, but it's actually the fact that he did die in 2010 is sort of surprising when you watch the movie, because
it's surprising right now.
Yeah, I imagine. But yeah, the movie was sort of made during a time when he was kind of a mess. And in the opening scene of the film, he's driving a truck with his daughter, who is played by Linda Manns, who was in Days of Heaven. And he crashes his truck into a school bus and kills a bunch of kids. And the bulk of the narrative takes place like 5 years later when he's getting out of prison. But basically every scene Hopper's in, he's just like completely drunk and a mess. And it was sort of surprising to watch the film and think like he somehow managed to live 30 more years after kind of being in this state. But the movie itself is very good, if kind of crushingly bleak. And it's sort of kind of in a way a response to like Easy Rider, which he directed about a decade earlier than this. And it's kind of about the fallout of that lifestyle and how it kind of not only, you know, ruined his own life in the film of his character, but kind of his daughter as well. Linda Manns is kind of amazing in the role as this girl who is like an Elvis obsessed person who kind of goes to concerts and tries to rock out, but she's a really tragic figure ultimately. And so if you're ever in the mood to like watch a very bleak film, and you know that Dennis Hopper has died, you're not harboring some belief that he is still around, then check it out. Although I'm pretty sure it's hard to find on home video.
All right.
With Dennis Hopper in mind, if you ever want to watch something equally as depressing, his Hollywood Walk of Fame acceptance speech it was a little tough to watch because he had deteriorated so much. And like, you know, if you remember him from his film roles, he always brought so much life to like whatever character he was playing, and to see the actual man himself, like, you know, age so poorly was pretty rough. I have no idea. I can look it up for you real quick.
Well, thank you for bringing that up. That's
I'll check that out.
Sorry. I didn't get all dark on you there.
Nick Newman, what about yourself?
I think I'll go with Manhunt from 1941. It's a Fritz Lang movie, one of his earlier American pictures, or rather one of his earlier English language pictures, which starts with the opening scene of this movie is the main character walking through the forest with a sniper rifle, and he looks in the distance, and he gets down, and he puts a sniper rifle to his eye, or rather the scope to his eye, and what he sees through his lens is Adolf Hitler. And the movie starts with him almost assassinating Hitler. He comes within about 2 seconds of it before he's caught. And it turns out he's in Nazi-occupied territory during World War II, right before World War II, I should say. And he gets captured and he escapes. And it becomes sort of this, you know, kind of like a, not exactly a spy story, but kind of like this tale of deceit amongst amongst governments and during wartime and whatnot. And then it kind of turns into this almost like a domestic romantic comedy with this English woman he meets. And then it turns again into like a thriller. And then it sort of ends as a tragedy of sort of the unstoppable march of war. It's a really fascinating movie. And it being directed by Fritz Lang, to say that it's a really well-composed piece of work, really well-measured piece of work, kind of goes without saying, but it certainly is. It's also a fascinating film, in part because if you think about sort of Fritz Lang's own life, where he fled Germany as a German Jew when anti-Semitism was sort of becoming more palpable in the country at that time, for him to make a film pre-World War II, mind you, pre-U.S. involvement in World War II, at least, where the opening scene is a character almost assassinating Hitler, is really fascinating. I had read that this was kind of like the first of a sort of an informal trilogy of Nazi-centered thrillers he had made. I've seen one of them, Ministry of Fear, which is a terrific movie. This would make a good double feature with it. Apparently it would make a good triple feature with another film, the title of which escapes me right now. But Manhunt was really, really enjoyable. It's it's quite odd, but that's kind of part of why I had such a good time with it. It's on Netflix Watch instantly. I actually just canceled my Netflix streaming account because I just wasn't using it. So this was like the last thing I watched. I had basically 3 hours to go. It was 9 o'clock because it was going to end at midnight. I thought, okay, I'll put this on. And It was a good way to go out. It was like one of the last things on there that I could think of that I really actively wanted to watch that I couldn't really get elsewhere. I don't think it's available. Or no, the disc is available there. But it is readily available through Netflix. If you, unlike myself now, have that streaming service, which you probably do.
Yeah.
You should check it out.
I'm pretty sure that the people in my house would murder me if I canceled my Netflix streaming.
Well, yeah, because it's all... Yeah, because like you watch like TV shows and whatnot, but...
Yeah. But you don't have time for that.
Ain't nobody got time for that.
I have at least 5 people who have my Netflix password. They'd be so mad. I get 9 angry phone calls.
I was about to say, like, my house has a thing where, like, one guy has Hulu, I have Netflix... And then, of course, we have HBO as the house. So, like, there was a point where my credit card got compromised, and so they sent me a new one. And it was, like, 3 weeks, and finally, like, one of the guys in the house comes up to me. He's like, Brian, I'm going to say something. And I don't want you to take this as an incitement that you need to do anything, but did you, like, get a new credit card? Or I was like, yeah, why? He's like, no reason. You know, I got home and I was like, maybe I should watch some Bob's Burgers and, you know, I just noticed that the Netflix isn't working. It's like, oh, I see.
Yeah, about half of Manhattan has my Hulu Plus login information. So if that was compromised, also HBO Go as well. A lot of people have access to that. So if either of those were to be compromised, I would have a lot of explaining to do. Yeah.
Oh, man. All right. Well, that's a fun way to end the episode. So, yeah, ladies and gentlemen at home, thank you once again for joining us. Tell us what you thought of X-Men Days of Future Past, either at podcast@thefilmstage.com, @filmstageshow on Twitter, or, find us on theactualfilmstage.com and post your comments on the post that this is appearing under. So let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found on the internet between now and next week, when we will be back to review James Gray's The Immigrant. Joe, as the guest, why don't you start off? Tell us where we can find you online.
Oh, that's how nice of you guys. You can find me on Twitter @JosephGalbo. Also, I run the Twitter feed for the Liberty Science Center, so you should definitely follow that.
Oh, and I had keep no idea.
I did, so please keep me employed, and also like us on Facebook. Thank you very much.
And Nick Newman.
Well, I actually run the Twitter account for the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, so no. In all truth, you can find me on thefilmstage.com and twitter.com/Nick_Newman, and I guess in 2 separate timelines, one of which doesn't really matter. That sounds very depressing.
No, to be honest, Nick, neither of your timelines matters. Danny King.
TheFilmStage.com, TheKingBulletin.com, Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin, and watching Dennis Hopper's Walk of Fame speech on YouTube.
So depressing. Don't do it. Be in a good headspace.
And you can find me on Twitter.com/BrianJRowan. I also write for TheFilmStage.com. And I have a personal site, dearfilm.net. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you once again, and join us next week, and we'll be talking about The Immigrant.